Hello and welcome back to Mess Explores with Xavier and Alan, where as always we'll be looking at all manner of films from around the world. Now remember to follow and subscribe to us on your favourite listening platform, as well as on Facebook, Instagram and YouTube, in order to stay up to date and get some extra goodies. This week we're donning our glasses and going server-side for Free Guy, so let's click play. Hello Alan.
Hello Save, and of course hello to our favourite fans, welcome back to Mess Explores. Before we begin to respawn in search of self-awareness, purpose, meaning and love, remember as always our podcasts are best enjoyed if you've seen the film prior, as we do contain spoilers. As Save said, we are looking at Free Guy, which is a 2021 film written by Matt Lieberman and Zach Penn, and directed by Sean Levy. Now, Levy has directed the Night at the Museum series and other notable films. Free Guy stars Ryan Reynolds, Jodie Comer, and Taika Waititi, just name a few. So with that being said, Save, let's get straight into the film. What did you think?
Well, this was a bit of a shallow film. Or was it? I'd originally gone into this film thinking it was just going to be a popcorn flick, but I think it may have been slightly more than that. Now, this is one of those films that, in a silly kind of way, lends itself to being overanalyzed to the point of ruining it as entertainment, and yet it's also completely unworthy of actually being looked at so deeply. So in a weird kind of way, I enjoy this film for the simple fact that we can get needlessly deep and meaningful about it, and that's exactly what we do at Mess Explores. What are your thoughts?
Ah, another dose of Ryan Reynolds. Doing what he does best, Save. That's what I thought. Look, I did find this film entertaining, but there were moments where I felt like it was sort of going in circles. Now, this film has aligned resemblance with two other previous films, The Matrix and The Lego Movie. And it's hard to ignore the similarities while watching this film. But I believe the crucial aspect of its charm is a brazen docility and ludicrous passion that proves alluring. Now, these qualities are delivered through actors, narrative, and a fast-paced action. But if I had to hazard a guess and attempt to peek behind the curtain, Free Guy is essentially about celebrity prowess. And in a heavily influenceable marketing world, this film is trying to be like Ready Player One. The Rolling Stones emphasize that we now operate in the entertainment ecosphere of intellectual properties, which begate endless franchises, which begate spin-off series, which begate side movies and multiverses and crossovers and origin stories and prequels, and obviously must-see streaming events. And I think Ryan Reynolds is aware of this. The 45-year-old actor is an alchemist able to transform what comes off as an inherent sense of entitled douchebaggery into an overwhelming sense of charm. But I think the key question is Ryan Reynolds becoming a one-trick pony? And to answer that question, let's just get straight into acting and character development. So, look, I might take the lead here, say Guy, our protagonist, is a non-playable background character, or what they refer to as NPC, and his archetype is essentially a cookie-cutter mold, another irrelevant citizen of Free City, destined to exist only to propel the game world and give meaning to the task of the external game players. His purpose is to lead a mundane life, carry out these ordinary tasks, and maintain the same inconsequential friendships, but in my opinion, he's anything but mundane. He's distinctively himself, and he's able to take over the eccentric trope to a point that isn't repulsive.
I like the point you actually likened this film to the Lego Movie. I hadn't thought about that, but now that I am thinking about it, I sort of went, yeah, I could sort of see how he would be that main protagonist in that film and how it all sort of sits in this artificial world within another world. But I think, you know, in terms of your comment about is Ryan Reynolds becoming a one-trick pony, I think Ryan Reynolds has carved himself out a nice little spoof arena in the cinema world. Sadly, it means I find him to be getting a little tedious and repetitive, though, and there is realistically no diversity between the likes of this and Deadpool. He's becoming a decidedly one-trick pony, and it's that sort of pony that doesn't stay in vogue. It becomes outdated very quickly, and to the extent where I even tried to watch Deadpool again only about 6 months ago, and while I'd enjoyed it on my first viewing, I turned it off after 20 minutes. I just couldn't stomach this humor because for me it had already become so dated. And I feel like Ryan Reynolds is only relevant as long as he is immediately in the here and now. And I think that's a dangerous sort of archetype to model your acting profession after, because when you cease to become relevant in the here and now and not just irrelevant after 6 months, you essentially have no career to fall back on. And I think he's leapt so hard into that he really is becoming a one-trick pony that people will eventually get sick of.
Look, it's interesting that you talk about Vogue and being relevant in Hollywood. And since the inception of Ryan Reynolds, you know, we've seen him play various roles of similar archetypes. And one of my favorite Ryan Reynolds movies is this chick flick called The Proposal with Sandra Bullock. You know, he was absolutely...
I love that film.
It's such a great film. And I think I want to see Ryan Reynolds in more of a romantic comedy forum as well.
Yeah.
But it's actually surprising to me how long he has actually lasted. And maybe his films may be one-time watchable flicks, but I think what he's able to bring to the table is this uniqueness that not many, if not any, actors possess. And it's that charisma that is just so audacious that it's absolutely hilarious and sometimes even politically incorrect. And it's really refreshing to see someone like that on screen.
Yeah, and I have to say, I actually liken the way he sort of modeled a persona and sort of made himself a brand to the way Dwayne Johnson has.
Exactly.
They've both marketed themselves as themselves being the product of their own identities.
Yeah.
And I think that really works. But I guess for me, where Dwayne Johnson differs is that he's made a much larger scope for himself. His identity isn't wedded to one character type.
No.
He's a bit more diverse both in cinema and outside of cinema. And I think that's why he's got a more enduring personality that more people can sort of bond with on different levels.
You're right. And I think, look, only time will sort of tell to see how far or how long his longevity will be. But I do agree with you, Ryan Reynolds and The Rock, they do share a similar playbook where they've diversified some of their earnings from films into other ventures like alcohol business and toys franchising.
Mm. But I guess enough about that. What about our main antagonist?
I love Taika Waititi and I think he brings such a great on-screen presence for anything that he does. And I really like him as a director. The only overly hyperinflated character was unfortunately the antagonist, and this is again played by Taika Waititi. Even though Waititi's performance is undeniably hilarious, the character itself is at times over the top, and it's obvious that, you know, he's there for comedic purposes, but there's no depth and no real substance to that character per se.
Mm-hmm. I think it's definitely deniable. I cannot stand Taika. I always get the impression he is so far up himself, he thinks his own deuce doesn't stick.
No way.
Yeah, look, I feel like he's still riding the post-Ragnarok hype train propelled forward by the likes of Chris Hemsworth. And frankly, I think he's completely undeserving. He's essentially a nobody that, in my opinion, hasn't really done anything particularly noteworthy. Now, I know this may not be a popular opinion, but I'm not here to be popular. I'm here to call it like I see it. And frankly, I feel like his goal is just to take the proverbial piss out of things and therefore make them inferior. And I feel like that's probably due to some deep-seated insecurity he holds onto, like the class clown that acts out because he's actually an idiot and doesn't want anyone to realize. And so for me, Taika Waititi just on the whole ruins content for me, and I really hated him in this film, just like I hate him in most other things.
And that was Mr. Grumbles for season 3, guys, so welcome back. I'm glad that he's still around, so fantastic to hear Mr. Grumbles make a comeback. Let's agree to disagree and let's move on to Jodie Comer, who plays Molotov Girl and Millie.
I actually unexpectedly liked her in this film. And yeah. I think I actually liked her more playing Millie than I did of Molotov Girl. Molotov Girl just kind of annoyed me to some extent. But I think it was more sort of the portrayal where they tried to go for that Scarlet Witch type of effect. And it just didn't really work for me because she is a bit more that girl next door type thing. And I felt that she really executed that character well as Millie in the real world, sort of feigning love interest with her old colleague and sort of their relationship dynamic outside of the free city. So on the whole, I think she actually portrayed her role quite well. I think anything that let her down was probably as a result of the screenplay itself and not actually her execution.
Yeah, look, I haven't actually seen her in many films, but obviously seeing her in this one makes me want to see her again. I thoroughly enjoyed both characters. I think, you know, as an action star, I think there is a little bit room for a slight improvement. But maybe that was just based on the script. It might have not given her the flexibility to show off her characters. But as Millie, she was gorgeous. As you said, the girl next door. And you can't help but fall in love with her. With that being said, say this film had a few underlying themes. And I know that we did dig deep for this film, but it's there. So let's get into some themes that you noticed.
Alrighty, well, yeah, I mean, as I said at the start, this was the sort of film that wasn't particularly deserving of diving deep and yet somehow lent itself to diving ridiculously deep into some of these things. So I guess the first thing I want to talk about is the fact that it speaks to the value of independence and free thought. And I think this is sort of probably the biggest overarching theme in the film. Tell me what you think about that.
Look, we notice that most of the characters don't claim their independence, even though there's nothing stopping them but each other, essentially. There's a scene that aptly showcases this, where Guy decides to order another coffee. And We see the ecosystem just break down. The cafe attendant just freaks out, the customers aren't comprehending the change, and I feel like this was a very clever way of highlighting that when people don't understand a problem and are cornered, they end up just denying everyone's opportunity and potential. And the notion of free thought was cleverly shown in how his mind, or in Guy's case, the algorithm, continues to expand when he has found meaning or purpose. Now, Benjamin Curtis, a senior lecturer in philosophy and ethics, states that Guy has no free will because his thoughts and action are a result of electronic operations going on inside the computer and he's got no control over. But then again, our thoughts and actions are the result of biological operations going on inside our brains and we have no control over those either. So if I was to expand on Curtis's argument, taking a libertarian perspective, maybe Guy's programming, along with our neurological parameters, purely define certain parameters among which free will is still in some way feasible.
Well, I think at the end of the day, though, if you look at all computing systems, they're all modeled after ourselves, albeit not necessarily brilliantly, but we are getting closer as time goes on. And I'm not for a second suggesting that we should nail it either. But I would argue that if you want to understand our most basic programming, look at the evolution of computers and you'll see our own human OS program, if you want to call it that. For at the end of the day, our own computers are simply a reflection on the basic parameters of functionality, which we would understand and therefore implement and then evolve with and build upon over time. And, you know, I guess free will is a nice concept and we could go into an extraordinarily deep dive around it at a theoretical and practical level. But at the end of the day, most of the decisions in our life boil down to a one or a zero. Do we do A or do we do B type of decision making, no matter how complicated we make the parameters on top. So even if you think about a complex computer system that we have in the 21st century, the fundamental principles on what it's still based on is essentially a yes or no type of response, irrespective of what task you're actually asking it to do. And I think that's sort of where you get this interesting look at the human programming versus the computer programming and how they actually align and are effectively modeled after one another.
And this film touches on both those parameters, but actually interweaves them together and gives this AI an extra conscience. And we see that consciousness take form, albeit in form of an algorithm, but it does branch out and it does become something more neurological or, I guess, more human.
Yeah, exactly. But again, you could argue that that's because it is modeled after us and therefore you would expect that its evolution follows the evolution that we may have followed at a programming level.
Right.
But we'll circle back around a little bit to sort of the definitions of what that may be as we get a little bit deep into this. But one thing I wanted to sort of ask, because we are talking about human versus AI, is what is the definition of existing? Yeah, most people go through the same motions in their everyday lives in terms of get up, have breakfast, go to work, have lunch, go back to work, come home, have dinner, and so on and so forth. We go through those motions. How is it any different to the programming of Guy in Free City going through the motions of his daily life when essentially he's just doing the same thing we would otherwise do in the real world?
I think the key difference between us and Guy is that I know that many people would define existence in many forms, but really thinking about this answer for me personally, I think it's the ability to have relationships, to explore our curiosities, to learn and experience emotion. And even though Guy does some of these things like relationships and curiosities, he's unable to do because he's limited by the scope of the map, or he's limited by, I guess, death or life itself, because every time he crosses a certain barrier, he restarts or he respawns, and his sole purpose is not to serve himself, but is to serve other people.
Okay, let me ask you this though. If your definition of his existence and its limitations is essentially the size of his map, you could argue that all of us face that very real issue as well in terms of the confines of our own world. If you strip away modern technology such as planes, trains, and automobiles, that world which we can explore becomes increasingly limited in how far we can actually go in terms of a practical, feasible application of our everyday lives. So too, as to whether we exist to serve our own purposes, you could argue that particularly in a capitalist society, we're not here for ourselves. We're part of a machine that's designed to make others money. It's the reason the vast majority of us go and work for someone else, spend money, and have to continue working. We end up part of an endless loop. So I guess at some level, and particularly a systems thinking level, you could argue that we're actually here to serve a purpose that is not really of ourselves. We just think it's for ourselves.
Look, I think the key difference between us is the fact that we have choice. Even though we choose to live our lives in these mundane forms, very similar to that of Guy, we still have the choice to do the extra. Like, we don't have the boundaries of a zone where we can't traverse. And even if we did take out all those means of transportation and the developments, it will take us back to that evolution process where necessity will yield results, right? Because basically our evolution has occurred based on our needs. The need to cross this river has yielded in the construction of boats. Our need to sort of traverse massive landscapes has yielded in the Industrial Revolution, trains, planes, etc. So that's one thing that Guy does not have, that choice. The choice to do what he wants and the choice to explore his curiosities.
But by that same token, you've just argued that we're constrained by our basic principles and all we've done is compounded greater levels of complexity on top of it, but it's still fundamentally based on the principles of which we need to survive, we need to eat, we need to cross a river. So you could argue we don't really have freedom of choice because our basic programming dictates and demands that we must execute certain basic functions in order to survive in the first place. Now, another interesting element that you can look at in terms of free choice is the likes of the Five Monkeys experiment. Now, it's an organizational culture model, but the basic premise of it is that you put five monkeys in a cage, you have a bowl of fruit sitting at the top of a ladder, and every time a monkey tries to go for the fruit, you set off an alarm or you spray them with water and whatnot, and the monkeys quickly learn not to do it. Now, you take one of those monkeys away, you leave the other four monkeys in, and you put a new one in, and that new monkey doesn't know why we don't go for the fruit. So it goes for the fruit, and the four other monkeys stop that monkey from doing it because they don't want to hear the sirens or be sprayed by water and whatnot. Eventually, it gets to the point where you've replaced all five monkeys, none of them will go for the fruit, and none of them know why. Now, you could argue that it's a choice that they don't go for the fruit, but they don't understand why they're making that choice because it's not based on their fundamental principles of we need to eat, therefore we need to survive. So it comes back to this whole concept of free choice and do we really have a choice? And the argument is no, because at the end of the day, we're all part of a system, whether we can see it or not. It can be simple or it can be complex, but it has a very basic and fundamental principle for its existence and the reasons it does, and that's essentially motivated by our drive and desire to survive. But bearing all that in mind and sort of why we make the choices we do, I guess the next question then is, what's the definition of a soul and, I guess, to some extent, being self-aware, and does it actually require a physical presence?
We have talked about soul and being self-aware in our Pixar Soul podcast, and for those of you who haven't listened to that episode, please go and do so. But in the context of this film, I'll address this question in reference to artificial intelligence. Andre Baran, a philosopher and an ethicist at the University of Perdubius, told the publication Futurism that AI people, or people who speak about AI, are routinely confusing soul with mind, or more specifically with the capacity to produce complicated patterns of behavior. The role that the concept of the soul plays in our culture is sort of intertwined with context in which we say that someone's soul is noble or depraved. And Baran added that it's come to a value judgment. And in his opinion, what's needed is not a breakthrough in AI science or engineering, but rather a general conceptual shift. A shift in the sensitivities and the imagination with which people use their language in relating to each other. Another argument, or another way of looking at this, is looking at Aristotle's three notions of soul, and in his writings, he congregates the idea towards an internal movement towards a specific end, to be internally moved to accomplish what you desire. And this is what we see with Guy's AI algorithm. It's something that I've already talked about before, where when he learns to love and he has that purpose and meaning, we see the algorithm blossom and we have all these timelines or branches evolving. Those might be mathematical equations, but it still represents his emotional consciousness.
Yeah, and I think the concept of, you know, when we sort of have these shifts, and like Guy, you know, he sort of came to a point in his programming where he felt love. You could also argue that at a human level, we don't necessarily have those feelings of love and infatuation and essentially what we think of as sort of an adult relationship until we essentially hit an age in what you could call our programming. Around the age of, you know, sort of 14, 15, 16, somewhere there where we start to notice the opposite sex and things like that. You could argue that our programming has defined parameters that only become activated after certain experiences, influences, or time has elapsed. But in terms of the soul, for me, the soul is nothing to do with the choices we make, but the rationale behind them. You know, it's not measured by whether you make a good or a bad decision, but by the motivation of the identity behind them. For instance, Guy does good actions, but he has good intentions. Therefore, he would be considered to be a good soul. But so too, if someone with good intentions makes a bad decision, it isn't the decision which necessarily makes them bad. It's the motivation that defines them, as long as it's still being good. Now, a soul is the measure of what we leave behind in others. It's what lives on in them as an existential element of our existence beyond our physical form, for better or worse. But with that in mind, if it is what we leave behind, then how do we measure death? You know, is it a pulse, or is it ceasing to think, or is it something more than that?
I think when one ceases to utilize or consume knowledge, and then eventually forgo reason, logic, and love, they sort of become enslaved to a metaphysical control beyond their ability to regain control, or to a point where regaining control is rejected by themselves. The biophysical death is the absence of pulse, but the psychophysical death is the absence of choice, mind, and control. And these are both potent as each other.
So I guess in the context of an identity on a server, where do you align this thinking? You know, is the destruction of a server or the loss of electricity a biophysical death, and the loss of a server's memory a psychophysical death?
Well, in the context of this film, if we sort of agree that Guy's AI has developed a self-evolving consciousness, then it sort of relates to a psychophysical death, right? Because it's still the loss of his choice, mind, and control. Even though those parameters are confined to a certain map, he still feels alive.
Okay, so on that basis then, what's the difference between a server losing power and our own mind? They're both governed by electrical currents. And in the case of something like Alzheimer's, how is the loss of our own memory storage any different to the loss of that on a hard drive?
Look, this is purely talking about Guy's algorithm per se. When we're talking about just the loss of digital servers with no AI functions or no sort of significant smart AI functions like Guy was, then I guess it's a little bit more obsolete, or it's very incomparable to sort of a human mind.
Is it though? Because if we take the programming functions back to that sort of primal basic function where we go, you know, the A or B's type of choice, our mind is essentially just a storage repository. So is a basic computer, irrespective of how complicated we make the programming on top of it. So if I lose all the photos on my hard drive, or if part of my brain is damaged and I lose all ability for photographic recall, what's the difference, AI or not?
This is a very significantly complex question. And I want to say that Alzheimer's patients, even though that they can't recall certain pictures, they still feel emotion, right? They can still attribute it if you lead them to specific memories of lived experiences, whereas computers can't do that.
But if an Alzheimer's patient goes so far down the path where they can't remember their own identity, as we saw in film like The Father, you could argue that their operating system is just as corrupt as that which is fragmented in a computer. And I guess this is where I'm getting to the likeness of AI in a computer versus our own intelligence in our own human physical form. What really is the difference? Because at the end of the day, they're both computers of some description.
Look, Sade, I think this is definitely a very complex question. And I know that they are working on transferring a person's consciousness to a digital platform so they can sort of continue to live even after the physical body deceases. But I think this is a question for the future to see how science and engineering co-create.
Yeah, look, I think it's going very much into a Black Mirror episode now. So let's pull up that theme a little bit, and I'll ask you this instead. Do we see our own world through a different lens in terms of the glasses motif in the film?
I guess the metaphor of the glasses for me sort of highlights our ability to accept the truth and seek change. Are we willing to put them on and seek an ulterior perspective? The glasses are a way of seeing our own lives through a different perspective and seeking out opportunities that exist in plain sight. The film sort of categorizes them as a tool to show the player where certain parts of the game are, like health or how to make money or where to buy weapons. But the truth of the matter is that all these are just aligned on the backdrop of the real world. So everything we need to obtain our own potential is sort of within reach, and that's how I've interpreted the metaphor of the glasses. And I guess no glasses needed.
Perhaps, and yet we have expressions in our own language such as seeing the world through rose-tinted glasses. And I was actually disappointed this metaphor was missed in the film. More often than not, I would say many of us go through life with a set of glasses on, each unique to ourselves and sometimes simply so others cannot see into our souls. But sometimes we're blinded by them too. Now, perhaps glasses aren't needed, but it's a rare person in my experience who is without them. Yeah, at some level, society issues them to us all when we're born to ensure we all see the world a certain way. And you could argue that's the essence of culture, how we see the world and why it's not actually the same for everyone.
I think that's a very astute observation, Seth, because now with the emergence of technologies, we're able to sort of interlace cultures. You know, like, I'm able to experience cultures more readily than a decade ago. And I think that's the beauty of this whole multicultural aspect of our existence.
And I guess at just sort of a very technological level, it's one of those things that could become even more crossed over as things like, you know, the failed Google Lens or Google Glasses, what it was, actually comes into sort of more the fore of reality. And we actually do have glasses on that augment our reality to some degree as well. So interesting times ahead. But I guess with that in mind, and speaking of things that we could see with glasses and whatnot within the context of the film, what are the barriers that prevent us from moving past our own existence?
Look, I think this answer is multifaceted, but some of the factors that I believe are the fear of failing and the fear of the unknown or not knowing any different. But I think we've already sort of touched on these concepts previously.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, we'll take it one step further then, sort of beyond the existence. How about the idea of Plato's cave and how we perceive our own reality? And so for our listeners who aren't across this is a story about a group of people who are confined and restrained in a cave and are forced to look at shadows projected onto the wall, which is created by outsiders walking past the fire at the entrance to the cave. Now, the allegory suggests that most people are not just comfortable in their own ignorance, but also hostile towards anyone who points it out. Now, Plato draws out that the masses are too stubborn and ignorant to govern themselves. So it could be argued that this was a theme prominent in the film when Guy attempts to free the other non-player characters, but they initially reject his heresy and stand against him until such time as it's made clear beyond all doubt. But what's important to realize is that the outsiders walking past the cave likely have the same ignorant beliefs coming from a different fire. And this is summed up nicely actually in Men in Black 2, when J and K open the locker to be praised as gods in one culture, only to later find themselves in a locker from a larger existence. And that's essentially the concept of Plato's cave.
Look, it's fascinating that you've made this distinction to the allegory of the cave, and it's basically an allegory presented by the Greek philosopher Plato in his work, The Republic, to compare the effect of our education and the lack of it on our nature. So when we look at this with reference to the movie, most of the characters behave like the characters in the story of the cave, consistently subjected to doing the same thing as they know no different or don't care. There's a scene in the movie where Guy confronts Buddy about breaking free and putting on the glasses, and he just can't bring himself to do it. As we go about our lives, can we be confident in what we know? Maybe one day we'll be subjected to other truths that dispel our original perception, and are these things in the real world just distorted imagery of real forms? And at these crossroads, will we go towards the truth, even if it comes at the cost of our family and friends? Or will we just stick to our ways and seek comfort through the known illusions like Plato's cave?
And I think the really interesting thing is if people are struggling to think of examples of this in the real world, in their lives and sort of current contemporary issues, you only have to look at things such as the concept of the flat earth. It's one of these things where people don't necessarily believe what they see, or they believe what people see is incorrect. And that's sort of one of these ideas about what is education versus what is nature, and how do you interpret and perceive that to be what is real? And is what is real only what's real to you? Or is that the definition of what is real? Only what is real to you? So it's an interesting story, and I guess this is the thing in particularly in the character of Guy. All that's real for him might be fake for us because we know it's a computer game. But for his existence, that is his reality because there is no world outside of his world because he cannot physically get to it. And you could argue that that's the same for lots of us on Earth, and the same idea as I mentioned in Men in Black, where they sort of open up the locker and they find that there's another world beyond our world and we're just a small part in a much bigger whole. Our perception is our reality and it's unique to all of us. We just try to create a whole as a society.
So just quickly, briefly touching on a cinematography save, the graphics on this film was what I expected to see in a film sort of centered around a video game. The explosions, the characters, world building were all sort of synonymous with the level of CGI that you want to see in high quality games. Now, it seems like the studio spared no expense, and the music sort of backed the fast-paced narrative, which made the entire viewing experience really enjoyable.
Look, I concur. This film could get away with being over the top because that was exactly what was intended in the universe it had built. So on the whole, there was absolutely nothing astounding or noteworthy in this film from a cinematography perspective, but it did exactly what it said on the can. And in that regard, that was perfectly fine for its purpose.
So with that being said, Save, let's wrap this film up.
Okay, so at the deeper, overanalyzed level, I think I enjoyed picking this film apart more now than I actually enjoyed watching the film as a viewing experience. It was better than I expected, but to be honest, I had gone in expecting very little. Now, to my mind, Ryan Reynolds is at a tipping point whereupon he runs the risk of becoming mundane, tedious, and irrelevant, as you can only play this sort of character so many times because it's just ho-hum same after a while, and particularly when he's determined to add in crossover elements as well, such as Deadpool. It just closes down his universe a little more each time, and Free Guy edged imperiously close to the edge for me. On the whole, though, I did really enjoy the deeper themes in this film, and for the fact that I could extricate so much depth out of a chintzy little film like this was quite a surprising pleasure. A bit like Hermione's bag with the extension charm. But I'm not going to pretend that this was in any way a good film, so I'm only going to give it a 4.3 out of 10.
Wow, Save, I did not expect that score from you, especially after those in-depth conversations we just had now. But for me, Free Guy is an action-packed family film that attempts to reel in what some consider the Fortnite generation. Free Guy also erates the significance of one's individuality and desired purpose. There are times where it's attempted to not feel like other movies of a similar genre like Player One, but then it plainly includes some of their image as reference. Now, the film has an entertaining cast, including what some critics claim to be an insurmountable work from Jodie Comer, who steals the show with Ryan Reynolds bringing the film together. Now, the film, however, is not without flaw, and there are times where it feels dry and repetitive. Maybe the intention was to emulate the regenerative nature of online gameplay, but to the audience, this just comes across as cyclical. Overall, the film was entertaining, and it espouses fun and contemporary depth. And it's for these reasons I'm going to give the film a 6.5 out of 10 save.
Okay. Well, that's all from us, folks. And remember, you can let us know what films you'd like us to do too. Just drop us a comment on our socials. But until then, we hope you've enjoyed yet another episode from us. And remember to give us a follow and subscribe on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And recommend us to your friends and family. But until next week, though, goodbye from us.
Goodbye, guys. Don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe. And we'll see you all next week.